Savitri, so as to try to get it an introduction or some idea which might create interest in us. It is not that we would be able to tackle the whole of Savitri. It's a big epic of more than 23,000 lines, and it wouldn't be easy to do justice to it in 3 days. So what could be attempted is only an outline and some kind of, well, some foretaste by which we might be induced to get into the body of the book. That's all an attempt. In fact, I consider myself this appearance of Savitri as the first ray of the new age that is coming in the realm of culture. Really speaking, it is the first dawn that actually gives us the promise of the coming new age. It is in fact the dawn of the new age. It begins with the symbol dawn, and I think symbolically it itself is a dawn in the new age that is coming to mankind. Poetry very often sums up an age and inaugurates a new age. And Savitri seems to be an expression which presages, assures us about the coming of the new age. It may take hundreds of years. It is not that tomorrow it will come, but that Savitri has been written now and has found expression in letters, well, that itself is a sign of the coming age. That is one thing I wanted to say. And it is a gift of the power of speech, as we say in India. You see, the goddess of speech is called Saraswati. You see, the goddess of inspiration. And Savitri is like a gift from the goddess of Saraswati, direct to mankind. It's not an intellectual expression of some individual. It's directly the expression of the power of speech itself taking form in words and embodying itself in panorama, which Mother says is like the prophetic history of the earth and embodying in itself the fulfillment of the man's life on earth, fulfillment of human life on earth. It is the prophetic history and at the same time reading of man's future fulfillment. It is the whole evolutionary span of mankind and even the whole of universe. It begins with the beginning of the universe, even before the beginning of the universe. And it ends at the point where man attains the purpose of his existence on earth. So that it is a song of the creation from beginning to the possible fulfillment which the poet is able to see and give us the sight of. We have dealt while we were talking about poetry, about the power of mantra. Mantra is the word that rises from the heart is by an act of inspiration. The consciousness itself, so to say, casting itself in word value or sound value, taking body itself, so to say, and Savitri in that sense also is charged with the power of mantra, mantric power, power of, you know, of recreating the consciousness which is represented in the word group or word symbol or word vibration. The word vibration is not only the word vibration, but is symbolic of a conscious vibration or vibration of consciousness. Therefore, the word vibration has the power to awaken in the man who is open the consciousness vibration also. It carries the mantric power, a power which is spiritual, charging the group of words with a capacity or a power to reproduce the condition of consciousness, you see, which the word vibration represents. This power of the word is not peculiar to Indian classical attitude or past India. I think the word power of word is not properly understood in modern times because people think that word that expresses a truth or a reality, well, it is intellectual generally, practical, turned to some use and so on. So they don't think that it has any other power. But if you study the growth of man's cultural movement or cultural activity, then you find that at times the power of word has brought great revolutions in mankind, you see. For instance, the Indian freedom movement was preceded by one word group, Vande Mataram, Hail to the Mother, Mother India. Now, it was that which came in 1872, much before the Indian national movement ever was even I mean, launched at all or thought of by the polit. There was no political life at that time to speak of. In 1872, Bankim Chandra Chatterjee, the Bengali seer, first saw this as the cry that must come to the sons of India in order to get their freedom. But it was not that we want freedom. It doesn't speak of freedom at all. Vande Mataram is a bow to the Supreme Mother, India. That's all. It only speaks of concentrating the attention and will of the people on an objective, you know, the collective entity, the Mother India, say Bharat Shakti, as they would call it, the Power India. And all the attention of people was drawn to that. And it is that for which many people went to jail, many people died, many people surrendered their property, sacrificed it, all for that purpose. But it was the power of this mantra. It was 1872 when it first came out in open. And its application took about 60 or 70 years. But that's how it works. There are other such things. I think, I don't know whether French national anthem had the same effect. Allons en face de la patrie. You see, perhaps that might have been after the revolution or during the revolution. I lost my memory about the composition of this national song of France. Apart from it, this cry from the socialistic attitude that, you know, workers of the world unite, brothers of the world unite. Now, that sort of expression carries a power within it which is capable of changing course of human life. Well, Savitri might in the end prove to be something like that. And it is not absolutely the past only where you see. Even a modern poet like C. de Lewis, if you read his works, you will find the world overall, a poem in which he says that why should we write poems when people are destroying each other? It's about the Second World War, you see. He says, what is there to write about? There is nothing much. And still word there must be to cry over the present, over the cratered present, to gleam in the future. Word there must be, you see, yes, to express that cry over cratered present. Because when bombing takes place, there is a crater created, you see, in the ground. And then the splinters of the crater are shining over the edge of the crater, you see. So he said, to gleam in the future. In another poem, the poet also, he speaks of the intuitive height to which the poet writes. The poet rises, you see. Oh, on the strident wing, you know that poem of his? I may have it here, I don't know whether I have it here. If it is there, I can give you. That is to say, C. de Lewis's song on poetry, on word, power of the word. I am only illustrating that even modern poets have got a little inkling of this great truth that an intuitive or inspired expression carries in it a great power. Oh, on this striding edge, this harebell height of calm, where intuitions swarm like nestling gulls, and knowledge is free as the winds that blow. A little while sustain me, love, till my answer is heard. Oblivion roars below, death's cordon narrows, but vainly if I have not slipped the carrier word. I am here on the strident height of intuition to catch the carrier word, because it is the word that, you see, that is effective. Well, it was... Just to give you an idea that word has been given a sufficient significance by even modern people. There is one idea which people have that epic in modern time is not possible. There are critics who have always said like that. I have dealt with it in this book. I don't want to go over it again. But there is an argument in the literary circle, in the literary world, that today this is not the age of epics. Epic age is past. It is primitive people's business and all sorts of things. They forget that epic, when the seer comes, he doesn't wait for the critics, you see. He doesn't take orders from the critics. It is like the spirit bloweth where it listeth, is it not? So, yeah, so it blows where it likes. And suddenly, when all the critics say such a thing can't happen, well, somebody says, well, it has happened here. Their idea was that in the primitive times, battles that took place between races or some prehistoric something which might have occurred and which had acquired a mythical value in the imagination of the people, and then imaginative things were added on to historical background, and somehow or other they made up a imaginative picture of society in which elements of culture, perfection, morality, ethics, life, goal of life, and everything was put together. That was a time when people were primitive. Now we are very much advanced, so we need not have that kind of epic. A story, you see. But story as an epic has ceased to be long ago. Milton's Paradise Lost is not a story in the strict sense of the term. It's with a, you know, with a, what you call a religious myth or religious background. Even though it puts forth characters, they are not human characters. Doesn't deal with a human event. Nor does Divine Comedy of Dante deal with any historical episode. It is not history. You see, Divina Commedia is something which deals with the conditions of the human soul, particularly after death and the conditions of man and so on. So that event or historicity is not necessary for creation of an epic. Even now, history has not been indispensable for creation of an epic. Well, here the epic has outgrown the objective attitude. It has now become subjective. From Milton's time onward, you can see that greater and greater subjectivity becomes the point of departure for an epic. And here Savitri, in that sense, is a far greater epic than all the epics put together. From Homer's time right up to Divine Comedy's time, the subjectivity that has found expression is a corner of the subjectivity that finds expression in Savitri. It's a tremendous affair. It's not one world. In fact, Savitri is universes. One, two, three, four, five, you get along universes, one after another. So that it is a complex, you know, creation of universes for which there is no parallel in the world's history, so far as poems and epic poems are concerned. Epic, therefore, here, when we say epic cannot be created, well, there is also a wrong impression in people's mind that epic must have a great event to inspire it. You see? It is not the size of the event. I have told that when we are dealing with English poetry, that it's not the size of the event that can give it greatness. The measure of greatness of an event is in the significance, in the meaning, in what people read into it. As I pointed out, that 1500 miles of front in the last World War was unprecedented in human history so far as military history of the world is concerned. Such a front never took place. So many people never participated in the world. What took place in Greece, I mean, in what is it called, this, in Troy, the Trojan War between Greek and the Trojans, is it not, was a tiny corner. It was nothing. Materially speaking and externally, it was something that took place in a corner of the world and nobody ever knew about it. And yet it could give rise to an epic because the significance was great. What people, you know, people participating knew that it was not for this or that. It was for values that they were fighting. Freedom of man or man's, you know, height or his heroism, his promise, his nobility. There was something at stake, not land and money and property and nothing material. Well, it is that which gives it the epic height, you see. The Mahabharata war, for instance, was only fought for 18 days. And that must not have been more than about 1/10 of a million people at the maximum. 1/10 of a million at the maximum. But Mahabharata war has given rise to an epic because the war was fought on, at least the poet saw it as, fight of values of life, as to what human being ultimately means. What is he here for? When that decision is given, well, understood, significance is understood, then it can give rise to an epic. When a war is a big war and only, you know, utilitarian interests are at stake, it doesn't inspire anyone. It doesn't inspire anyone. And you will see this contradiction, I mean, contradictory though it looks. If you look at the course of the last even world war, it really came to a head, means spiritually, to something when the Atlantic Charter was declared. It had to rise to a height of idealism before it could, you know, concentrate the willpower of humanity for a complete, you know, showdown. It could not have been fought only, I mean, it could have been fought certainly and would have been still worse. But I mean, it began with this exterior materialistic utilitarian practical values of frontiers and commerce and the balance of economic, you know, distribution of the world and exploitation of fields of getting raw materials and all that. I mean, a complex, you know, of causes which led to that. But they were all, you know, wedded to the vital life of man, that had nothing to do with man as the highest creature of creation. Man as a divine spirit, man as an idealist, man as a noble creature. Those values had been, you know, lowered down on collective life. Well, that is why it doesn't inspire. It creates a sense of, you know, that, oh no, what we did was wrong. All the time, everybody thinks, I don't think only those who participated in the war, all human beings who were not even partisans, they also think that was not right. No, that was, we didn't do good. That's it. Well, that is it. And here when some, and even when the parties had to fight, as I said, they had to rise to an idealistic plane before they themselves could also create in their collective life and among mankind a will that it was worth fighting. It was worth fighting and winning. Naturally, it was a question of rights of man, freedom of association, freedom of belief. Yes, many things which have nothing to do with frontiers. So, oh, well, an epic comes into being when values are there. You see, the epic has come into being because he has seen the world situation. And in the world situation, the values of life that have now been churned, so to say, and something has to emerge out of the churning. We say when you churn milk or buttermilk, well, you know, butter or something which is the very product of it comes out. Well, Savitri is the result of that churning, and without taking notice of the undesirable element, it just says, if you churn, well, this is what you are in for. If the world is churned of its in its present condition, what do you expect as a result of this churning? Well, a fulfillment of man on earth. In what does lie the fulfillment of man on earth? Savitri gives the answer to it. As Mother said, his prophetic reading of the world's history and the promise of its fulfillment. Now, what is this Savitri? He calls it a legend and a symbol. And the legend is as old as the Mahabharata, the epic of India. He has borrowed it from the epic of India. Well, before I go into the story, I'll give you opinion of one of my friends, Dr. K.R. Srinivas Iyengar, head of the English department, Andhra University. In the world of letters today, he is somebody who can count, whose opinion counts. He says it is in its final form, it's a poem with hardly a parallel in the world's literature. I'm quoting Dr. Srinivas Iyengar. The Mahabharata story of Savitri and Satyavan is now rendered anew with scaffolding unimaginably vast and undertones of incalculable import, written in blank verse, but with a weight of thought and edges of articulation unattempted ever before. The poem with its 23,000 lines spans earth and heaven, comprises life, death and immortality. It is a modern divina comedia in which paradise is lost and won. Man learns to exceed himself, and Savitri, the girl wife, becomes mother might and vanquisher of death, and also the creatrix of life divine on this terrestrial base. Sri Aurobindo often speculated on contours of poetry, future poetry, partaking of the power of the ancient mantra and achieving the instantaneous communication between souls, awakened and awakening. In Savitri, he brought out such effects again and again, and criticism is almost dumb before a feat so stupendous and unique. Well, this is opinion of a friend of mine, and it is in PEN, you know, the booklet with the PEN, people bring it up. Now, what is the symbol and what is the original legend? Well, the legend is simple. Savitri was the daughter of a childless king, and because the king Ashwapati was childless, he performed askesis, as we say in India, tapasya. He tried to perform penance, as we say, in order to get a child. And for 18 years, she performed the penance, sacrifice, and gave charity, and so on and so on. So four chapters, I think, of the Mahabharata, 248 to 252 chapter of Mahabharata, Aranyaka Parva, the great epic. You see, it appears there in the four chapters. It is verse form, very simple verse. 248 to 252, only four chapters. The whole original legend is contained in Mahabharata. And there the king performs penances, and then the goddess to whom he is trying to propitiate is pleased and comes out of the sacrificial fire on the last day, and asks him for demanding a boon. So he demands a boon, and then she grants him the birth of a son. And then as she is pleased with him, she says, well, from myself, I give you an extra boon that you will also have a daughter who will be my portion. Something like that, she says, you see. And so then the goddess goes away, and the prince and the princess are born. Savitri is born like that. And when she grows to age, well, she is brilliant in her character and power of strength of character. So nobody comes forward to offer his hand. In those days, this custom was that the bridegroom goes to propose to the bride. The bride does not ever seek the bridegroom. That was the law in those days, the society at that time. And as nobody dared to come forward to claim her hand, well, the father, after waiting 2 years, told her, the king Ashwapati, that you better go out and see whether you find somebody who can be your companion. So she set out with a minister, and 2 years and some little more, 2 years and a half, went over all over India, visiting all important places and capitals of these various states. And she didn't find anyone that she thought was, well, worth her attention, till she came to a forest where in the forest there were some huts. And in the forest, a king who was dispossessed of his kingdom on account of, you know, his enemies getting the upper hand, and he lost his sight. He became blind. So he was dispossessed of his kingdom and driven out of his territory. And he was living in the forest outside his own kingdom, in another kingdom, where his son was attending on him and his wife. The king and the queen were, so to say, living in exile practically, and the son was looking after them. So she thought this young man was really an ideal young man, and so she decided in her mind to select him as her future companion. But she came back from the travel to her father to report. And when she came back, then Narad, the great divine sage, was sitting with the king and the queen, and they were talking when Savitri came. And then the king asked her about her choice. So she declared her choice and said that Satyavan, living in a Shalva country somewhere and living in the forest, was somebody whom she had selected. So the king thought it was quite all right because it was her choice. But then king thought, in India they always have horoscope, you see, the astrologer. So horoscope was cast, and he asked the great Narad sage, who was a divine sage. He said, you cast this horoscope and see the position of the constellations in their future life and see whether this marriage is happy, this match is happy. So Narad cast the horoscope and said, yes, it is all right, but there is one catch, that this young man will die after 1 year. He is going to die after 1 year. Well, then everything was upset in a certain way, and the mother and the Everybody said that, but you are not yet married, you are not given your word, so you can simply go again and try to find out somebody else. And Savitri refused. That's the original story, and she insisted that she is going to stick to her decision and take consequences. Well, the result was they were married. And after 1 year, the god of death came and he died, and she pursued the god of death to his home in the upper regions, or in the region wherever the dead go. And she released and persuaded him to release the soul of Satyavan, and he revived. And she came back and they went back home. That is the story. Well, that is the original story. Now, this is only a simple story in a legendary way, a myth, a certain kind of myth. But it is a significance behind it. And Sri Aurobindo took hold of the significance for his work. Now, Ashwapati in this epic is not a king who is childless. Ashwapati here in this epic is the representative of human race trying to fulfill the inmost aspiration of the human being by bringing down a kind of perfection in life. Aspiration for perfection is his one, you know, flame. And in that, he is representative of the whole human race. He is not a king only in that sense. And he is not asking for a child. No. He is, first of all, trying to find out what man is. What is a human being? And he finds that human being is not merely his mind and life and body, a bundle of desires and material elements of carbon, hydrogen and oxygen and so on, or merely thoughts and ideas only, but he is a spirit. And that there are capacities and powers in him which he can awaken and by which he can come to himself. So he follows a triple yoga. Well, that yoga will live aside for the time being. Now, he is the representative of the human race. And as a representative of human race, he, first of all, tries to find out the true self that is in man. And then he finds that man is cosmic. He is not merely an individual, but man is cosmic. And then he finds that not only cosmic, but something beyond the cosmos also, he can ascend to a plane of consciousness where he can be identified with the Supreme Divine. So he ascends, and then he goes over to those regions and enters into the house of the spirit, as he calls it in the third book. A plane of consciousness where the universe is overpassed, and he enters into the house of the Supreme Spirit. And there he encounters or meets the creatrix, the mother of the universe, and carries the whole aspiration of mankind for thousands of years that has been, you know, working here in human heart to her feet, and lays it at her feet and says that unless and until an emanation of yourself is sent down in mankind, mankind will not be able to fulfill the highest dream of his aspiration or highest dream of his ideals. It will be only when you send down an emanation of yourself that man will be able to fulfill himself in the divine. First, the mother persuades him not to press for such a demand because earth is not ready, mankind is not ready, and she pleads a long, long poetic passage in which she shows how man is incapable and not ready, I mean not qualified now, and ready to bear the descent of anything so high as the divine consciousness. But Ashwapati persists, and by his persistent prayer and his sincere aspiration, he succeeds in persuading her to extend her grace, so to say. And then she, at the end of long, you know, discussion, grants him the boon and says that, all right, I'll send down an emanation of myself on earth, and that will help mankind to conquer ignorance and death. That will help mankind to conquer ignorance and death. And so the boon is granted, and then Ashwapati returns to the earth. Well, then Savitri is born and so on. That is how the symbol works, you see. When Savitri is born, then she grows up, childhood and birth, you see, adolescence and you know, youth, and she knows that she has gone through her educational course and she has gone and met Satyavan. And then after meeting Satyavan, she chooses him. Now we are going to the double movement, you see. That is the old legend we were. Now here we are in the symbol. So after birth, she goes through her course of education, adolescence and youth. And when she develops, she goes out and meets Satyavan. Here, the going out is not on account of It is Ashwapati who one day sees her coming. In the sixth book, you will see that he once sees Savitri approaching one day in the palace, and then he's suddenly thrown into a mood of meditation. He was meditating at that time, and when she approached, he forgot that it was his child or his daughter. He simply saw it as a spirit that was coming, some unknown spirit born his child. That is how the Savitri text says, you see, an unknown spirit born his child. And then he felt that she had her own mission to fulfill, and that, well, she has come here for fulfilling the mission. And so he told her that, why don't you try to fulfill that which is your inmost wish? So next day she leaves her house and goes out. And when she goes out, well, the description of the country she traverses is very wonderful and beautiful in the fourth book. It is one of the great passages in world's literature. Those passages which we are going through is not merely the prosaic way, but it's a very poetic way. She travels all over and passes through spiritual, you know, atmospheres and different persons in deserts, in out of the way sylvan, you know, retreats and the capitals of kings and so on. And she does not meet. At the end, she comes into the forest where Satyavan is living, and well, they meet. That is in the fifth book where the meeting takes place. It's the shortest portion of the whole writing. Within 14 pages, the whole, you know, intensity is finished. I mean, the meeting of Satyavan and Savitri occupies hardly 14 to 15 pages. And then she comes back, and Narada is sitting there, as in the legend also. In the symbol, Narada is there trying to persuade the king to look at mankind and do something for it, and singing the song of man's perfection and so on. She walks in at that time, and Narada asks, who is this girl who has come? And she is introduced to Narada. And Narada feels that this is a great spirit. It's not only his daughter, but somebody who has extraordinary power. But he doesn't say that. He only says something, that who is this extraordinary lady who has come? And that description of Savitri at four places in the epic is one of the highlights of literature, you see. First, when the poet describes in the first canto Savitri as one standing one day previous to the death of Satyavan, preparing herself for meeting the god of death. That's one. Second point is when Ashwapati sees her approaching in the palace, you see, and the description that that the poet and Ashwapati, through Ashwapati, what is given. The third is when, Savitri is described by Narada. The divine sage who describes human beauty. It is height of world's literature. There is no world, nowhere, anywhere, something that can come near it. It is the description or appreciation of human beauty by a divine being. And it is, you must read it in order to see. You see, it simply says like that. What is it? Who is this that comes, the bride, the flame born? Who is this that comes? She was approaching, you see, Narad sees her. Who is this that comes, the bride, the flame born? And round her head, you know, lights, hymeneal lights playing. And then he says, oh, the empty roses of thy hands are filled with their own beauty and the thrill of a remembered clasp. Narad, the sage, is a yogi, and she has selected Satyavan and come. You understand? This is a, you know, throwing back of the yogic knowledge in the aesthetics, you see? Yes. What is it? The empty roses of thy hands. The hands are like roses, you see. The empty roses of thy hands are filled with their own beauty and the thrill of a remembered clasp. Because she has met Satyavan, you see. And Narada, as a Devarshi, the divine sage, is able to perceive not only the empty roses and the beauty of her hands, but the thrill of a remembered clasp. It is, you have to first say, many people, I think, when they read it, pass it over their head, you know. It doesn't, unless you cultivate the power to look, you know, inside and go to the to the thing that is expressed, then only you get at it. Otherwise, it says, oh, it's fine description. It's not. It is something that has not happened in the world's literature. Well, that they chooses, and then Narad is describes her. That is the third time, and fourth time is when she's facing death, when she's face to face with the god of death, and the description which the poet gives of Savitri at that time. Four, you know, aspects of Savitri, like a human person. You find that it's not simply some ethereal being which the poet describes, but sufficiently human with that charge of the divinity in it, which is four aspects gives you in a way which shows that Savitri could be a very, well, person in flesh and blood, probably. Well, here, when that is, this is a description of Savitri. I was talking to you about the selection, and then Narad predicted that he's going to die after 1 year. So the mother told the daughter in symbol that she first questioned Narad that why should pain be there? In the world, why should suffering be there? And suffering unmerited, because my young daughter or this young Satyavan has done nothing wrong. As far as I know, my daughter has been brought up by me, and I know that she is absolutely innocent. Now, how is it you are working of what you call a divine wisdom and a God who is merciful and kind and, you know, all knowledge and all goodness? How is it that in such a world created by a merciful God, unmerited suffering comes to a human being? Understand, the sixth book, this problem of pain is thrashed out in detail as nowhere in the world's literature it has been thrashed out. I can tell you from direct study that the problem of pain has not been as well understood anywhere as it is in these two cantos of sixth book of Savitri, where Narada is fronted by this mother and by Savitri's mother, the queen. Like sorrow. What is that? Like sorrow. She spoke like sorrow. Yes, she was like an embodiment of sorrow addressing heaven. Yes, like sorrow appealing or addressing heaven, she spoke. You see, and she said, who is this God that has created this world? And is this a God who created this world? And so on. Was the God important before a power? Either some power other than God, or God who is not merciful but cruel, and so on. I mean, no atheist has put the case of, you know, non-acceptance of God more powerfully than you find in the sixth book of Savitri. Very strongly, the mother of Savitri puts the case of her atheism and also requiring or demanding origin of the problem of suffering and pain in mankind. And the answer that you get is something also that has not been given in anywhere in philosophy or literature. The answer is radical and new answer. It shows the place of pain in the growth of man's evolution and shows the necessity which has invited pain in this cosmic scheme. You see, and how pain in its ultimate origin is nothing but a perversion or a distortion of the original delight of existence. It is the original delight of existence only which is felt as plain because of the receiving apparatus, which is, you know, call it, it is distorted or perverted, and therefore, instead of receiving the delight, it reacts to it in the form of vibration, which it feels as pain. That's all. It is, I'll read it when it comes to the passage, then you will see some side of it, you see. It may be tomorrow, perhaps, but. So after that problem, Narada answers roughly by saying, oh, was then the sun a dream because there is night? That is how Narada begins to answer. The beginning of answer of Narada is, oh, was then the sun a dream because there is night? Because you are living in midnight now, well, the idea or conception of sun that you have, could you reduce the sun to an unreality? Because now you are actually passing through darkness. Yes, was then the sun a dream because there is night? And so Narada answers, ultimately, leave her to her own fate. She will meet her own destiny in the way she is intended to by the inner spirit. Don't mingle and don't try to interfere in her, you know, in her decision. Don't try to change her decision. That is the advice Narad gives. And Savitri sticks to her decision and then she performs tapasya. So as the yoga of Ashwapati proceeds along, the self-knowledge and universal knowledge and takes entrance into the divine knowledge. Well, here Savitri goes into the constitution of the universe and enters deep inside. And she meets all the universal powers that are at work and find that the universal powers themselves are incomplete and imperfect. Universe is not perfect because the powers working in it are not perfect. Therefore, she says, well, I'll go back and bring powers from the divine, which will give you what you lack, what is wanting in you. Three great powers Savitri passes in her passage. One is Madonna of suffering, the psychic fortitude or toleration in the whole human consciousness, humanity, where in spite of greatest suffering, the human being puts up with life because subconsciously or consciously there is a hope. The hope of fulfillment or whatever is in the human heart. This Madonna of suffering is the cosmic power which allows man to continue life in spite of all reverses, in spite of all difficulties. Well, that is the Madonna of suffering. And Savitri sees that she is the great support, the psychic support to all life. But it has no power to prevent pain and suffering being inflicted. It suffers with faith, but it has no power to prevent. So it says, I will go and bring the power from the divine so that you will be able to prevent. The Madonna of Might is the second power through which whom Savitri meets when she goes into an inner life. The Madonna of Might is the will working in the cosmic, you know, life, whole of human life, whole of humanity's life, which keeps a sort of rough order in the evolutionary movement, keeps the upward trend. Madonna of Might is, well, the human race gathering all its willpower in order to maintain a sort of rough order in a world where everything would have become infrarational if this Mother of Might was not there to maintain some higher values of life, ethics, idealism, religion, morality. Something is being kept up by a conception of right, conception of justice, but it is this universal power which maintains some values in life so as to allow life to take up the upward turn. And then Madonna of Light means an intellectual power or mental power working in mankind, which enriches life by intellectual gains and intellectual idealism. These three powers she meets, mainly three powers that are working in mankind. And she says, all these are imperfect. I will go to my inmost divinity and bring back to each the element that it lacks. And Savitri goes into her soul, into her divinity, and comes down. When she comes down, then there is this death of Satyavan takes place, you see. And she is standing face to face with the god of death. And there is a long debate between the two. Tenth book is also very simple, very simple. I mean, there can't be simpler book in poetry than that. Because all the questions that come to man, death is arguing all the time with Savitri that she's unnecessarily trying to revive somebody who is dead, because it is no use trying to revive. You see, she says, if Satyavan had lived, love would have died. It is better that Satyavan is dead and love lives in your mind, you see, and so on. He argues all the sophistical arguments that you can imagine. Death is given to Savitri and says that the one is the only true, then why do you want to? The divine is only one transcendent, unique, inexpressible, infinite reality. It's only one. Why do you want somebody else to love? It will be introducing a duality into ultimate, which is the one reality, and so on. Oh, all kinds of arguments death is putting forward to Savitri, and Savitri is answering every time in the light of her inmost being. She is not answering as an individual, but as the representative of the power, and the power is replying to God of Death through her Savitri. So it's very clearly made in the poem. You see, very clear, absolutely. She says, I have no need to revive Satyavan at all. Well, if it is fated that he must die, all right, let him die. Then the spirit in her says, wakes up and says that There was a mission given to you, and you cannot be unfaithful to the mission. You must fulfill the mission. That is how Savitri then says, all right, then come along and do what you want to do. Then the spirit begins to speak. And it is throughout 10th book, it is the spirit of Savitri, the divine original motherhood, that is speaking in her. This is Savitri. And she answers death, and then death says that I also want the divine. I am set to work by the divine. I am not working on my own. And so Savitri also says, you are the divine, only you are not the whole of the divine. And so you must now, she says, all right, if you are the divine, then manifest the divine that you are, then I will be fulfilled, because it is for that that I am waiting. I am at work because the divine has given me the command that mortality should be there for man's evolution. Well, I am working on behalf of the divine. I am deputed by him to work. And if you are the divine, well, you reveal your divinity, I will submit. So Savitri reveals her divinity, and death is swallowed, so to say. It is leaked up, as they say, electrical power. You see, an ocean of electricity comes, and like a dark, you know, hill in the midst of a great ocean, the god of death is swallowed up in the flames of electric light of Savitri's, you know, consciousness. And then Satyavan and Savitri both rise into the eternal sun, or everlasting day, as he calls it, everlasting day. And in the everlasting day, they look upon mankind and try to bring down the ray of the eternal sun, the knowledge of truths, into the world, and try to change the world into a divine life. Well, that is roughly the whole story of the epic, you see. Now it begins with the symbol dawn. Where is this watch? I've lost my watch. Have I lost my watch?
My
or what? I didn't bring my watch. How can
five
I?
To 11 for 5
to
11.
Huh?
It's about 11. 5 to 11.
Yeah. No, but how is that? I forgot my watch today. That's what happens on the day of Savitri. You live in eternity, you don't live in time. Now, the beginning of the poem is symbol dawn. The poem begins with the dawn, and the dawn is not this ordinary morning rise of the sun. It is a symbol dawn. Now, this dawn that is spoken of as a symbol, illuminating dawn of the higher and undivided consciousness, is always the dawn of the truth. Usha, the goddess of dawn, is that illuminating dawn. Sun follows the path of Usha. Sun follows the path of the dawn. Night in the Veda is a symbol of our obscure consciousness, full of ignorance and of stumbling in our will and in our acts. Light is the coming of illumined higher consciousness, which leads to truth and to delight. Usha is the power of Aditi. Aditi means the supreme infinite consciousness, mother of the gods, according to the Veda. In a more general aspect, she is the source of all cosmic forms of consciousness. The dawn is the source of all the cosmic forms of consciousness from the physical upwards. Usha is the mother of the cows, and it can only be a power of the supreme light, light of the supreme consciousness, Aditi. The non-existence of truths of things is the first aspect of things that emerges from the inconscient ocean, and its darkness is the Vedic night, which holds the worlds and its unrevealed potentialities in her obscure bosom. Night extends her realm over this triple world of ours, physical, vital, and mental, and out of her in heaven, in the mental being, the dawn is born. Dawn delivers the sun out of the darkness where it was lying concealed and eclipsed, and creates the vision of the supreme day in the non-existence and in the night. This is the symbol dawn, in the sense of the first awakening of man to his divine potentiality, to his divine possibility. That is a dawn. Dawn is the awakening of the human being from his limitations of physical consciousness, his desire consciousness or animality, even from the limitation of his mind, to the perception of a divine essential element in him. That's the dawn. It can come in the midst of life. Dawn can come in the midst of most ordinary experience of life. Dawn does not come only when you are in a pious mood. Dawn comes when your inner being is ready. Then a flash is thrown across life, and then you suddenly see that there is something greater than everything that the world can offer, which is the object of existence. Well, when that glimpse is given, that is the dawn, you see. Dawn is the awakening of man to his divine potentiality and possibility with a flash, with a light, unmistakable, convincing, and capable of evoking in him an aspiration which can lead him to fulfill the first vision of the dawn, you see. Dawn is the first promise of fulfillment of spiritual life in man. Now, the dawn, we cannot take up too much with the dawn, because it is the beginning of the universe, you see. And it's the picture of the night, really speaking, like a lady who is asleep. I'll give you roughly the idea of the picture that is there. It is, dawn is the awakening of a lady who is asleep, a dark lady, with no light at all lying in the whole cosmos, occupying the world, occupying the universe. It was the hour before the gods awake. That is how the book begins. Savitri begins with this sentence. Symbol dawn, the first sentence is, it was the hour before the gods awake. Even the universal powers were not yet set into functioning. That is the time. So it is primordial. It is just before the cosmos was organized. So you have to imagine somebody who is occupying the whole universe, completely dark and resisting any attempt to awaken. You see? It was hour before the dawn, before the gods awake. We want the first line, all right? Five lines you can have. Across the path of the divine event is the coming of the dawn. Across the path of the divine event, the huge foreboding mind of night. Night is the lady who is asleep. Huge foreboding mind of light, night. Alone in an unlit temple of eternity, lay stretched. Huge foreboding mind of light, night lay stretched, immobile upon silence's march. And she doesn't want to be awakened. So there was an effort to awaken her, and it was a nightmare, and she threw it out. Second time, somnambulist movement was inaugurated. You know, somnambulism is a condition in which a man is fully asleep and yet goes out and does something very sensible and rational, forgets all about it, and next morning when you ask him, he says he didn't do it at all, and it's quite wrong to say that he did it. But he does it. That's somnambulism. So first, when the nightmare was over and she did not awaken and the pressure was being exerted from inside, well, a somnambulist movement caught hold of her, and this material universe came into existence. The stars and the constellations began to move, like a somnambulist, you see, working in sleep. And Earth was there, most insignificant place in the whole cosmic material scheme of interstellar bodies, which was moving like somnambulism. And in it, the earth was there. No light, no sky, nothing. And some idea, some will began to work in that. And suddenly, out of this unconscious ignorance awoke. And a ray began to penetrate. And, disturb this night. And night refused to get up. But some ray penetrated, because past memory also of the creation came back to this lady, and she said, oh, past we had done something. So let me see what happens. And then when the ray came, well, the ray took the form of a child, became a child, and got hold of the sleeping lady. She would not get up. So the child goes and puts his hand on the cheek of the mother, and she thinks, oh, I have moved everything in somnambulism, but here is a child that I have to take care of. And so she sets about, well, trying to get up. And when she fully gets up, there is a dawn. You see, it's the waking of human. And then Savitri awakes. That is the poet has connected this dawn with Savitri's last day when she is fronting death. On the day when the night has, you know, allowed the ray to penetrate and allow the full blaze of morn to come. The description of the morn is very fine when it first break off, you see. In the first canto itself, first canto is a little tough. Therefore, you shouldn't read it at one time. You must read it 25 times before you get anywhere somewhere. Before you get somewhere inside, you see. Yes. Hardly, you see, then what happened was darkness failed. This light, night lady, dark lady sleeping. Well, darkness failed and slipped like a falling cloak, like a cloak that falls. There is a dark lady sleeping, is it not? Yes. Darkness failed and slipped like a falling cloak from the reclining body of a god. It found that it was not night, it was a reclining body of a god. Reclining body of a god was revealed when the cloak of night fell down. Then through the pallid rift that seemed at first hardly enough for a trickle from the sun's outpour the revelation in the flame. When this was revealed, then light began to penetrate. Then through a pallid rift that seemed at first hardly enough for a trickle from the suns, outpour the revelation in the flame, the brief perpetual sign recurred above, a glamour from unreached transcendences, iridescent with the glory of the unseen, a message from unknown immortal light, a blaze upon creation's quivering edge. Dawn built her aura of magnificent hues and buried its seed of grandeurs in the hours. The seed of grandeurs was sown in the hours, buried the seed of grandeurs in the hours. Then the higher power also supports the dawn, and the divine power is standing behind the dawn, and so on. We go over to Ashwapati's yoga, because that is the yoga with which we have to deal ultimately, except one point on which we can have a little, we can tarry a little. Savitri is described in this very canto, first canto. And there he says that she was semi-divine, but full of human elements also. The leap for the element of desire that comes to the human being and creates a kind of leap came to Savitri also, but it came to her like a, well, sweet alien note. The desire did not come to Savitri as if it is as if it was something new, something known to her. Yes. The call that wakes the leap of human mind, its checkered, eager motion of pursuit, its fluttering hued illusion of desire, visited her heart like a sweet alien note. He is not describing Savitri only as a divine being, you see. Visited heart like a sweet alien note. And then he says, a magic leverage suddenly is caught. A magic leverage suddenly is caught that moves the veiled ineffables. Well, where is it? Yes. Timeless will A prayer, a master act, a king idea can link man's strength to a transcendent force. Then miracle is made the common rule. One mighty deed can change the course of things. A lonely thought becomes omnipotent. Savitri was faced with this problem of conquering death. And the poet is putting before us an idea as to how can one individual conquer death. The working of a cosmic machinery, grinding wheels, one heart is standing before it and wants to stop it. That is how he puts it. I am putting the poetic description almost. You see, the wheels of the universe are grinding and one heart has come and wants to stop it. How can it be? So this is one couplet which I have selected just to put before you. A magic leverage suddenly is caught that moves the veiled, ineffable, timeless will. A prayer, a master act, a king idea can link man's strength with a transcendent force. Then miracle becomes the common rule. A lonely thought can become omnipotent. You understand? Yes. Now imagine man in a darkness. A thick room with all cover of thick walls of darkness all around. And he is trying to fumble. He is fumbling out for a way out. He scratches somewhere and makes a little dent. Well, if he constantly makes a dent, naturally the thing will break and the opening will come and perhaps whatever is beyond will reveal itself to him. But if suddenly his hand drops over a lever or an electric switch, so to say, and it happens to press, well, then you can get the light immediately. A magic leverage suddenly is caught. You think that one man is working and one man is doing. Yes, of course it is one man. But he catches a magic leverage. And that moves a veil, ineffable, timeless will. It does not move human agency, but moves some divine powers. What could be those levers? A prayer. It can be a powerful lever. A master act, some action which one does in obedience to his inmost spiritual entity. Or a king idea, an idea comes in the mind and seeks expression in life. Well, in that case, it sets into movement the machinery of the transcendent force. And then what people call miracle happens because the lever is moved by a human agency, but the power that is at work is not human. People think that, you see, unless we do, then these things cannot be done. Yes, man has a part to play. He has to touch the lever, consciously or unconsciously, you see. Yes, set it movement, but to set movement is enough work for man, you see. To set the higher leverage working is not easy for man to do. That is his whole effort is that, how to move the leverage. Well, when that is put, then people think that, oh, how can such a thing happen? We pray every day, we go to the church and so on, or we go to the temple, is it not? But they are not praying at all in the church. I can tell you, and in the temples, nobody is praying. If that was real, more things are wrought by prayer in this world than this world dreams of, you know? It was Tennyson, is it not, who said mm-hmm. that? Yes, more things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of. But then it must be a prayer, is it not? Some people, when I was talking to some audience in India, you see, a university boy asked me, and he said that, oh, I said, how can, I said, look, you want an historical incident, I'll give you. So I said, yes, you know the history of India? Yes. You know the first Mughal king who conquered the north of India? His name was Babur. Yes, yes, yes. And his son's name was Humayun. Yes. And you know that Humayun was ill. And he was a mortal illness. And Babur was the only son. So Babur went 7 times around his sick bed and prayed that his illness be transferred to him and that he was ready to give his life for his son. He died on the 7th day. This is record, his own record. Babur has written his own autobiography, you see. This is in his, and this is historically, I mean, authentic fact, because it happened in the 16th century nearly, you see. And Babur has written his own annal, as you call it, record of his own daily life, you see. And because Humayun was taken ill and he was quite young, and this, so he was the only son, so he went around and prayed to God that I will take all his illness, and if he is to die, well, I pay for his life with my life. Well, Babur died. So if you want a very historical incident, there is one to show you that efficacy of prayer is borne out by facts in life. Well, and prayers are not for immediate efficacy. Prayers are only to move the higher, will to do what is best. Prayer is not for receiving the answer that one desires. It is wrong on the part of human being to say that what I pray for must be given because I pray for it. And that is, I told those people, you remember? I don't know whether it was here. Yes, we were talking at Phoenix when we were coming back. You know, my desires are many, Tagore says in his Gitanjali. My desires are many and my cry is pitiful. And yet did thou save me by hard refusals. He is telling the divine that by not fulfilling my desire, you have saved me. So prayer doesn't mean that what one asks for must be given. Otherwise, it's not God. That's what people think. It's not true. Prayer is only an appeal to set into movement the higher divine consciousness and allow it to do what is best, what it believes or thinks or considers best. That's all. That is what can happen. Well, a masking idea, a master act, when you say, master act is, I illustrate it sometimes by giving the illustration of Gautam Buddha leaving his house at dead of night to relieve suffering of mankind. You see, it's an action which he did intuitively, instinctively, or under an inspiration of his inner being. When he did it, even as I told you, 50 square miles round did not know anything about that action. It was the age when transport was not so known and communication was very primitive. Gautam Buddha's abandonment of his house, renunciation of his family, in order to find out a remedy for suffering of man, is an act which is, well, master act, what master calls here the master act. That's the master act, which moves the higher will, and how many millions of people afterwards knew about it and tried to understand something of what that act meant, you see? A king idea, an idea which comes to one human being, liberty, equality, fraternity, well, and immediately catches somewhere and moves, and then nations and groups of mankind, you know, undergo change. Well, that is how the machinery is set into movement. I think we can better postpone Ashwapati's yoga tomorrow, otherwise you'll never come to the end. I have done Savitri for 1 year and 9 months, so every day 1 hour. So don't expect to go to the end of Savitri.
Karani, would you, I felt once more the last, like, desires are many and my cry is pitiful.
Yet did thou save me by hard refusals. Right. And yet did thou save me? My desires are many and my cry is pitiful. First line. Second line is, and yet did thou save me by hard refusals. That is Gitanjali, you'll find in Tagore's Gitanjali.
Yeah, Savitri was originally written in English, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, of course.
Does it work? Of course, it's been translated into many other languages, Indian languages, hasn't it?
Not yet. In Bengali, some portions, in Hindi, some portions. Okay. A poetess who is working with me, Vidyavati Kokil, she is translating in Hindi and says that it would be.
Are they able to maintain the mantric qualities and the translation?
Very difficult.
Very difficult.
She is working. She is going through 3 translations. She has done 3 versions already, this lady who is working with me. She's a poet. She is herself a great poet and a very good poet. She has done it 3 times, all the portions, and she's going it 4th time, 5th time, like that. But she'll come to something. She'll come to something. Because she's concentrating only on the quality and on the inner stuff and not on success. So she will come. She's a disciple, so she will get some help.
You were speaking about song with a mantric quality. It's interesting to know that in our history, the last songs that were written that had any quality such as that were written in the Civil War. This was before the age of science and reading. In the Battle Hymn of the Republic and John Brown Foddy were probably two of the most stirring anthems written in this country. But in World War One and World War Two, there was absolutely nothing that had any
relation. Yes, that's it. Because it was on the principle of equality of man, freedom of man. The fighting within the two wasn't the slavery, question of slavery, is it not?
Well, I think that the ideal that this country entered into World War One and World War Two were equally high as they were, but we just weren't translating in the terms as we were in the,
reduced in economics.
Yeah.
Yes. You had to. We're compelled to. That's the worst of it.
I think the ideals were just as high. Yes. In fact, I think
otherwise the Atlantic Charter would not have come into being at all.
I don't think some of the ideals were too credible in the Civil War. I mean, there was much more selfish interest in many cases in the Civil War than there were in World War One, World War Two.
He gave the second preferred passage. The first one was preparing herself to meet God of Dare. And the third one was Father Street's friend by
Narada, in the sixth book.
No, but the second one I didn't get.
Second was Ashwapati, seeing a Savitri approaching. It is given in the appendix of this book. You will see that in the appendix of this approach and study which I have written. You see, if you refer to appendix, all the four are given there in body there.
Yes.
All quotations with the passages, you know, relevant passages here. It is just to help the student. What has happened? That Whitman himself has given expression to it for the first time in the last century, now 100 years ago. It was Whitman who said that why should we take the idiom of Europe? And why should we, idealize the characters of Greek mythology or European history and so on? There is sufficient grandeur all around here in a democratic country where we are living. People are performing deeds which are equally capable of being called heroic, you see? Well, with all that idea is right. But his own poetry doesn't create such character that can stand by the side of the characters created by the classical poets. That is a fact of now 100 years have passed and time has passed the judgment. It's not nobody's personal opinion.
No.
No, he has not succeeded in creating one. Yes. Average man and average, citizen raised to that height. But because the average citizen has not risen to that height also, how could he do that? He wanted that he saw that the positive potentiality is there and every citizen could be great and grand, but well, the performance has not justified it. So that is there. And I also grant that there is no point in repeating what has been done in the past in poetic world. What has been done need not be repeated. It's not necessary to repeat the past. You have to create the future, you see. And in order to create the future, you have to have a vision of the future. It's not necessary to go back to the past at all for, seeking form or seeking guidance so far as the technique is concerned even. You can evolve your own technique. It's quite possible. Passing through a period of uncertainty and churning. We are not yet out of the whole thing, you see. We have not come to any ground. It's Savitri first gives you the inkling that there is a new age and you can create greatly, you see. But Savitri is exceptionally so great that probably 50 years will be perhaps not sufficient even for men to realize what Savitri is. I am not surprised and neither disappointed. It's nothing. 100 years will be perhaps the time when people will think, oh, this was something. That's all. Because you are passing through a period of turmoil and uncertainty of values. You see, everything is now, you know, thrown into the boiling pot. So there are no values on which you can depend today in cultural life. And the worst, the values that are there are not worth the grandeur of man, the greatness of man. So there we are. We have to see how this churning ultimately results into some precipitation of, well, man seeking his ultimate fulfillment in a direction which will show that he is now, well, moving to the fulfillment of his true essential being.
Trying to reach that lever. Give us some
life. That push button was also an electric economic necessity. Because I found that to pay for the man would be more costly than to press the button. Because if you had to have a man who was to do the job, then you had to pay him. And then paying the man would cost more than pressing the button.
That's the history of our economy. Yes.
Stanford, we were there in the coffee room, I know. And Spiegelberg was there, so he was telling, oh, you see here, everything we do like that, and so on. So, and then he said, I don't think it myself very marvelous, he told me. But then they said, why don't you set up people who can serve also other people and have more human contact? I told him, just, by the way, we're lightly just taking coffee and talking lightly, you see. So he said, yes, but you don't know. It would cost us more. To get a man means more money than the money that is required for pressing the button.
Well, this is one of the problems, dilemmas with education in this country, because education is one of the...
But now they're trying to have a machine for education?
...activities that they haven't been able to translate into machine.
They are doing it. They are already... I went to the factory where the machine was there, Albuquerque.
The double-eighths every individual, the same gear ratio, every individual.